From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With the 2020 presidential race reduced to one candidate from each major party, the two presumptive nominees, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, will face one another in a general election this November. Which means now is the perfect time to remind ourselves that Americans don't actually vote directly for president. We vote for electors in an electoral college that then determines who the president will be. Given that our current president won the electoral college vote in 2016 and lost the popular vote by 3 million ballots, is there any more evidence needed that the current system is flawed? My guest, Jesse Wegman, thinks so. He's written a book about it. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board. He writes editorials on the Supreme Court and legal affairs. He was previously a senior editor at the Daily Beast and Newsweek, and a legal news editor at Reuters, and managing editor of the New York Observer. His new book is called Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Welcome to the program, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought we would begin our conversation with playing a short video of how how the electoral college system actually works. And I simply went to kids.gov, which is where, as a parent, if you wanted to explain the complicated system of how the electoral college works to your child, how the president gets picked, you might show them this video. Well, here's the relevant piece of that video.
When people cast their vote, they are actually voting for a group of people called electors. The number of electors each state gets is equal to its total number of senators and representatives in Congress. A total of 538 electors form the Electoral College. Each elector casts one vote following the general election. The candidate who gets 270 votes or more wins. The newly elected president and vice president are then inaugurated on January 20th.
And that is a short clip of a video that you can show your kids on kids.gov, which is basically called How to Become President of the United States. Jesse Wegman is my guest. His book is called Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Is it as simple as what the video suggested?
It is pretty much. I mean, the way that the college works is that these electors who are allocated to the states based on their representation in Congress as well as the Senate vote for the president after receiving the votes of their states, the popular votes of their states. I think one thing that people may not understand is that not only do they not have a direct vote for president, they don't even have the right to vote directly for those electors. That is purely up to the states themselves to decide. Now, all states today allow for a popular vote in the state to choose those electors. But in fact, there is no requirement in the Constitution that they do that. State lawmakers could decide for themselves how to award the electors without including the public at all. So you have no right as an American citizen to play any role at all in the election of the president.
So that right to vote directly for president is not actually a constitutional right. It's not enshrined in the Constitution. It's something that we have at the behest of basically all 50 states.
Right. I mean, the right to vote itself isn't in the Constitution. The Supreme Court has read it into the Constitution through various provisions and amendments. But there's no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution, and certainly there's no right to vote for the president.
So let's look at the reasons why this was put into place in the first place. Why did the framers of the Constitution choose this method of picking a president instead of a simple direct popular vote?
It was a really interesting debate. It was the most fraught thing that they battled over at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787. Several of them said this afterward, that no issue vexed them more than this one. They spent 21 different days debating it. They held over 30 votes on it. And in fact, several of the most influential framers in Philadelphia supported a popular vote for president. This includes James Madison, who's widely regarded as the father of the Constitution. And they lost. And why did they lose? Well, there were several concerns that were at play here. One of them was just the circumstances of the day, right? This is a time when there's no communications network, there's no transportation system between states. Most people stayed very close to home and didn't really know anything about circumstances or politics outside of their local communities. So while the framers did give a right to eligible voters, to vote directly for their members of the House of Representatives, they decided that it was going to be too risky to give that same right to vote directly for national candidates, that is, candidates for the president and vice presidency. And that's because they felt that people wouldn't know enough about those candidates, being very, you know, locally based, and that they would therefore perhaps make a bad decision. That's one of the explanations that we've heard, and that there is some truth to that. There was also, I think, the issue of slavery, which was central to all of the compromises that were made at the convention. The three-fifths clause, which counted slaves as three-fifths of a free white person for the purposes of representation in Congress and taxation, gave the South a great deal more power in the Congress than it would have had otherwise, because they get to count all these people that they don't give any right to vote to. And the South was understandably unhappy about giving up that extra power in the voting for president. If we had a popular vote for president, the South would have lost all of that power because they didn't give slaves the vote, of course, or any other rights. So slaveholders in particular were not in favor of a popular vote for president. James Madison says this openly at the convention. He says, "I think a popular vote would be best, but the South won't go for it."
So we have a situation today where the Electoral College is not really considered that seriously until you have races where the popular vote and the Electoral College vote have different winners, like the one that we just had in 2016. And as far as I understand, Trump's winning of the Electoral College and loss of the popular vote was quite historic in that he lost the popular vote by a bigger amount than any president who had won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote had.
That's correct. Trump's loss to Hillary Clinton in the popular vote of about 3 million votes equaled a little over 2%, a loss of over 2% in the popular vote. And that's the biggest losing margin by any president in history, by anyone who becomes president in history. It's happened five times that the popular vote in the country and the Electoral College result have not matched. This was the fifth. Obviously, the one right before this was in 2000 when George W. Bush squeaked out an Electoral College win over Al Gore, even though Al Gore won about 500,000 more popular votes in the country. But one thing I just want to point out is, while that is definitely the most salient example of how the college fails our modern democracy, it doesn't have to happen for the college to do damage to the country. So I just want to point out, even in years when the popular vote and the Electoral College line up, which is most years, right? In 2012 and 2008, both elections that Barack Obama won, the Electoral College result and the popular vote margin lined up. But the Electoral College still caused harm to the country in the way that it functions. And that's because of something called the winner-take-all rule. And this is what all but two states currently use to award their electors. What they do under the winner-take-all rule is exactly what it sounds like. They give all of their electors in the state to the candidate who wins the most votes in that state, regardless of how much they win by. They could win by a million votes or by a single vote. That candidate gets all of the state's electors. That causes huge distortions to the system of representative democracy, even when the candidate who wins the popular vote also becomes president.
Right. And so we end up having this phenomenon of swing states. You know, this is a term that gets bandied about a lot. It means that presidential nominees only campaign in a handful of states. And it also, as far as I understand, means that sparsely populated states, the residents of sparsely populated states, actually have a greater say over who is president than the residents of densely populated states, right?
So there are two different things going on here. Yeah, you're correct on both counts, but there are two different phenomena. The first one, which is what you said about swing states, is absolutely true. There are only a handful of swing states in any given election year. This year, we're looking at maybe half a dozen, including Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Arizona, Florida. That's really it, maybe one or two, give or take. And what that means is the candidates and the campaigns understandably focus all their attention on those states. And that's because of that winner-take-all rule I told you about just now. There is no point in campaigning in states that are not swing states. In other words, that are states where the campaigns both know they're either going to win it or lose it. That's true for more than 40 states every year now, every time there's a presidential election. There's really only this small handful of states where the outcome cannot be predicted in advance, and spending a lot of time and money might move enough votes into your column to win all of that state's electors. That's why Donald Trump won in 2016, because in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, three states that together cast more than 13 million votes for president, Trump won by a combined total of 77,000 votes.
Wow.
So because of those 77,000 votes spread out across those three states, he won all of the electors in all of those states, and that's what gave him the presidency. So you move those, you move half of that, 30, 38, 39,000, whatever it is, they switch their vote to Hillary Clinton, and suddenly Hillary Clinton is president.
Right. And we see this kind of ability these days with digital marketing and Facebook ads to micro-target just the right kinds of voters in just the right kinds of states to essentially hack the electoral college system, to game it and win, which is what happened in 2016. So no matter how you cut it, whether the electoral college vote lines up with a popular vote or not, this is clearly an unfair system. What are some of the means by which it can be abolished? Because it seems to just end up devolving. Anytime we have this conversation, it ends up devolving into partisanship and partisan bickering. Republicans are convinced that the less democratic our country is, the more likely they are to retain power. You know, whether you look at things like the Electoral College or gerrymandering or so-called voter fraud and their resulting voter ID laws. So does it seem that there are any realistic paths to abolish the Electoral College?
Yes, it's a complicated, I'll give you a slightly more complicated answer than you might want. But just to go back for a second to your point about hacking or gaming the system, I would approach it slightly differently, only to say, I don't think they're hacking or gaming anything. They're doing exactly what campaigns naturally do, which is to focus on constituencies that they think will help them win the election. That's what all campaigns do everywhere. And that's a fine way to approach politics. The problem is that swing states only represent about 20% of the American electorate. Only about 20% of Americans live in swing states. That means that 80% of Americans are left out of the conversation every 4 years. They don't matter to the candidates. They don't matter to the campaigns, and they don't matter to the president. Presidents of both parties routinely ignore all the voters in those states in favor of small slices of, you know, potentially very meaningful votes in the swing states. That's the problem. What we want to see happen, and what I'm arguing for, and what people who argue for the popular vote argue for, is not that campaigns don't target voters and try to win over certain constituencies. That's great. That's what they all do. It's that it needs to happen on a nationwide basis, because this is the only office in the country whose job it is to represent everyone in the nation. You have state governors, and you have lawmakers in states, and you have senators, and you have House of Representatives members. Those are all state-based. The presidency is national, and it should be elected nationally. How do you get there? It goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is that states have total authority to choose how they award their electors. Right now, 48 out of 50 use winner-take-all. Two states use a different system whereby they give their electors based on congressional districts. That's Maine and Nebraska. And I can explain that system in a minute if you'd like. But the way that you get around this, there's something right now called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. What this is it's an agreement among the states not to abolish the Electoral College. You can only do that through a constitutional amendment. And that's been tried at close to 700 times in the nation's history. This is the most fought over provision in the entire Constitution, but it hasn't succeeded. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact does not amend the Constitution and it doesn't abolish the Electoral College. What it does is it uses the power in the college that states have to award their electors. It says, states that join it say, instead of giving our electors to the winner of our vote in the state, we will give all of our electors to the winner of the national popular vote. And when states representing a majority of electors, that's 270, as that kids.gov video told you, 270 electors, which is the majority of electors in the country, when states representing that many electors join this compact, it takes effect. And then automatically, the candidate who wins the most votes in the country becomes the president. Now, that solves two problems at once. One is, it avoids this problem that you discussed of the person who wins fewer votes winning the White House, which I think just violates our basic fundamental sense of majority rule. Children understand this, right? If you win more votes, you win. But then it also solves the problem that I was describing of too much focus on these swing states, because candidates who need to win a national popular vote will go everywhere to win those votes. They won't just focus on the Floridas and the, you know, Michigans and the Arizonas. They will focus everywhere and they will try to win votes everywhere, because you need all of those votes to win. The National Popular Vote Compact has 15 member states now and the District of Columbia, with a total of 196 electoral votes signed on. That means they need 74 more electoral votes to get to 270, and then it takes effect and we elect the president by a popular vote.
So you don't actually need all states to jump on board. You need enough states whose electoral college votes add up to 270.
That's right. And you could get there any number of ways. You know, the unfortunate thing at the moment is that the only states that have joined the compact are states led by Democratic, you know, have Democratic leadership. That doesn't mean that there's no Republican interest in this compact. In fact, chambers in four different Republican-led states have passed the compact, but it has not gotten fully enacted in any Republican-led state so far. They came very close in 2016, but as soon as the election turned out the way that it did, I think everyone sort of realized the partisan implications and ran back to their corners. It was a real setback to the cause of the compact. I write at length about the compact in my book because it's such an interesting, elegant solution to getting us to a popular vote without actually violating the Constitution. People often say, oh, no, that's unconstitutional, or it's an end run around the Constitution. In fact, it's not. It's using the Constitution exactly as it's written and exactly as the founders designed it.
Perhaps if we have an election where a Democrat wins the Electoral College but loses the popular vote, you might get the balance on the side of the Republicans to want to reform the system.
Forget the compact. You would have a constitutional amendment tomorrow. Remember, in 2012, Donald Trump, then a private citizen, tweeted, the Electoral College is a disaster for democracy. Why did Donald Trump tweet that? It's because on election night in 2012, it looked very briefly like that scenario that you just described might happen, that Barack Obama would win the Electoral College while losing the popular vote to Mitt Romney. Donald Trump understood what everybody understands in their heart, which is it's not fair for the loser to win and the winner to lose, right? So now he obviously, you know, he knows which side the bread is buttered on, and he has a different take on it. But I think what he wrote in 2012 is much truer to his heart and truer to what all of us feel about this.
And so is it a matter of getting enough awareness about this issue? I mean, we've covered the National Popular Vote Compact on our program, but it doesn't seem to be common knowledge. I'm not seeing, you know, a lot of coverage in the media about it.
This is the frustrating thing about the Electoral College, right? It's that most people don't even think about how we elect our president except in the few months before an election. Then they get all worked up about it. And especially if, you know, we see what happens in 2016 happens when there's a split in the popular vote in the Electoral College, people get very upset and then it fades away again. And I think one of the things that's been encouraging in the last few years is that I don't sense that same drop off in interest in the issue about how we elect our president. That's why I wrote the book, is because I think it's really possible to latch on to that sense of unfairness and that sense of undemocratic, a process that leaves out so many voters in the country. And really to kind of harness that energy and to try to get people to start talking to each other and talking to their state lawmakers about at least adopting the compact, if not moving ahead with a constitutional amendment. And I'll just say, you know, you asked earlier a good question, which was, do the sparsely populated states have more of an influence than the larger states and the more populated states? The answer is yes, but that difference, which is caused by the fact that every state gets two electors for its senators, that difference is actually almost minuscule, it's almost meaningless compared to the power of the winner-take-all rule, which is used in virtually all states. So while a Wyoming voter will have almost four times the voting power in the Electoral College of the popular of a California voter, it doesn't really make that much difference in the end. Wyoming only has three electors. California has 55. Since California gives those 55 on a winner-take-all basis, that's much more consequential to the outcome of the election.
I see. So can you identify which states are good organizing grounds right now for this National Popular Vote Compact? If we need just a few more states to come through to reach that magic 270 number, where are places that are ripe for organizing?
There are several states that are, I think, very possible next steps for the compact to take. Virginia is the most obvious one. Virginia was one. The Democrats just took over Virginia in this past fall, so they now have a trifecta in the state, which means they have the governorship and both houses of the legislature. They've been passing a lot of new laws because of that new control. If Virginia joins the compact, then you have about 209 electoral votes, so that's only 61 away. After that, you're looking at states like Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. But, you know, with a few more big states like that, you could definitely get to the 270 that you need. But once again, I think this is in the interest of all states, small states, big states, medium-sized states. They're all ignored under the current way we elect the president, and all of them would benefit by a national popular vote.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jesse Wegman, for joining us today. Appreciate your time and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much.
My guest has been Jesse Wegman. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board, writing editorials on the Supreme Court and legal affairs. We've been discussing his new book. It's called Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.